Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. More than half of the inmates in federal prisons are there to serve time for drug offenses. We all know that. That's not a big surprise anymore. Of those, most are African-American men caught up in this web of mandatory and other sentencing policies that require lengthy stays. And then after they're released, these ex-felons are tagged for life. And that's not a new topic to the show either. But joining us today is the author of a new book. It's called The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. Michelle Alexander currently holds a joint appointment with the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity and at the Moritz College of Law at Ohio State University. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
You know, the title of your book points out sort of the obvious dichotomy that we're colorblind, so why is there a problem? How could there possibly be a new Jim Crow, which is the former legal system of segregation and discrimination in the United States? How could that be if we can't see it, if we're colorblind?
Yes, well, the book argues that, you know, within a few decades after the collapse of the system of Jim Crow segregation, we as a nation have managed to recreate racial caste. Although we claim to be colorblind, the institutions and systems that we've designed operate to create, maintain, and perpetuate racial inequality in similar ways as Jim Crow segregation once did. In some major American cities, the majority of African American men are locked behind bars or labeled felons for life. And once labeled, they're trapped in a permanent second-class status in which they can be denied many of the same rights we supposedly won in the civil rights era: denial of the right to vote, automatic exclusion from juries, legal discrimination,
public housing,
employment, housing, education and public benefits, all suddenly legal once you've been branded a felon. And the war on drugs has targeted communities of color for mass incarceration, resulting in the emergence of a new racial undercast, a lower caste of people defined largely by race, who are relegated to a permanent second-class status for life.
Why do you use the word caste versus class?
Well, I think, you know, people have this idea that in America, no matter who you are, what circumstances you were born into, you can make it if you try. There's some recognition that there may be classes in the United States, upper, middle, lower classes. But most people imagine that the days of caste are long gone. And I use the term caste deliberately here to, you know, draw attention to the fact that we have a legal system in place, a system of laws and policies that trap people in an inferior second-class status, that they're trapped in this inferior status by law, not by choice, not because they lack the determination or the willingness to make it. Laws authorizing discrimination in virtually every aspect of social, economic, and even political life make it close to impossible for people to make it, even who are determined once they've been branded felons.
If you're just joining us, this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU, and my guest is Michelle Alexander. She currently holds a joint appointment with the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity and the Moritz College of Law at Ohio State University, and she has a new book out. It is called, let's get it straight here, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. How we're talking about – shoot, I lost my train of thought. I'm wondering about the idea of our consciousness of the racism of the system. That's kind of part of the problem. Is it's that you make the argument that it's so ingrained now that we've all had the Kool-Aid now, and it's how do you separate the racism of it from what we take as a natural situation?
Yes, well, there are a host of colorblind explanations for the circumstances that many African Americans and other people of color find themselves in today. You know, the popular supposedly colorblind explanation for mass incarceration is crime rates. But as I describe in some detail in the book, crime rates do not even begin to explain the sudden and astounding rates of incarceration in poor communities of color today. Crime rates, particularly violent crime rates, have fluctuated over the last 30 years, and today are actually at historical lows. But incarceration rates have consistently soared. The incarceration rates in the United States have quintupled in a very short period of time, the span of just a couple of decades. We've gone from a prison population of about 300,000 to more than 2 million. And this is not the result of, drastic increases in crime rates. No, it's the result of a war, the war on drugs, a drug war that has been waged almost exclusively in poor communities of color, even though studies have shown now for decades that, contrary to popular belief, people of color are no more likely to use or sell illegal drugs than whites. Now, that defies, our basic racial stereotypes about who drug dealers are. We think about a drug dealer and we typically think about a black kid standing on a street corner surrounded with his buddies and his pants hanging down. And while drug dealing certainly happens in ghetto communities, it happens everywhere else in America as well. But the drug war has been waged almost exclusively in ghetto communities, resulting in millions of people of color being arrested for relatively minor, nonviolent drug offenses, the very sorts of offenses that occur all the time on college campuses, universities, and middle-class suburban white neighborhoods and are largely ignored. And once branded, and many of these, kids are branded at young ages for these relatively minor offenses, once branded, you enter into this parallel social universe, in which all of the rights that everyone else takes for granted are suddenly denied to you. One survey of employers showed that up to 70% of employers would not even consider hiring someone who had been branded a drug felon. 70%. Never mind that most Americans violate drug laws in their lifetime, but if you've been convicted of a drug felony and you have to check that box on the employment application, overwhelming majority of employers won't even consider hiring you. And public housing is off limits by law to people branded felons for a minimum of 5 years. Food stamps are off limits to you for the rest of your life.
Student aid?
Yes, student aid can be denied to you as a result of drug offenses. And, once you're released from prison, you're often saddled with thousands of dollars in fees, fines, court costs, accumulated back child support. Some states now actually charge former prisoners with the costs of their imprisonment. And up to 100% of their wages can be garnished. So if you're one of the lucky few who actually even managed to get a job after being released from prison, up to 100% of your wages can be garnished to pay back all of these costs, fees, fines, accumulated back child support. What do we expect folks to do? Can't get food stamps, no housing. Many homeless shelters now screen for criminal convictions. And you're one of the lucky few actually get a job and up to 100% of your wages can be garnished. It's no wonder that the overwhelming majority of people released from prison return within 3 years, about 70% return within 3 years.
And that's because so many of them are African Americans. So it's just this cycle. It's part of that.
Well, yes, because African Americans have been targeted through the drug war, they comprise a very large percentage of those who are branded at young ages, unable to get work or find housing, and cycle in and out of prison often for the rest of their lives. Discrimination against them is authorized, for life. People who committed an offense 20 years ago are still required to check that box on employment applications, on applications for housing. As a result, we find that in large urban areas, the majority of African-American men are trapped in this, cycle of permanent marginalization, cycling in and out of prison and trapped in a permanent underclass.
The numbers are staggering. In the Huffington Post in February, you wrote that there are more African-Americans under correctional control today, including parole and that sort of thing, than were enslaved in 1850, a decade before the Civil War began.
That's right. The scope and the sheer scale of the system is staggering. you know, and the political consequences are immense as well. You know, in 2004, for example, there were more African Americans disenfranchised as a result of felon disenfranchisement laws than were denied the right to vote in 1870, you know, the year the 15th Amendment was ratified, prohibiting laws that explicitly deny the right to vote on the basis of race. You know, it was reported in the 2000 election that Al Gore would have won the election by an easy, you know, wide margin or relatively wide margin if felons had been allowed to vote in Florida. And so, you know, we see that, you know, in a population that had been, you know, explicitly denied access to the right to vote is once again, although this time they're labeled felons first.
Yeah, and it's funny, you know, just even when you said that Al Gore could have been elected if only the felons could have voted. And there is this, you know, there's a connotation to that word that's very scary and very negative. And it isn't just we don't think of just some kid who got busted for smoking pot or maybe dealing a couple lids. We think of something really scary and horrible that should be segregated from society.
That's exactly right. When people
think
about felons.
That's not an accident is one part of your thesis.
Absolutely. When people think of felons, they typically think of, you know, violent felons. But it's also the case that when people think about drug use and drug crime, they tend to think of, you know, violence associated with a drug trade. And that is no accident. I describe, you know, the history of the drug war in my book. And, you know, most people imagine that the war on drugs was launched in response to rising drug crime or the emergence of crack cocaine in inner city communities. It's not true. The current drug war was officially declared in 1982 by President Ronald Reagan at a time when drug crime was actually on the decline, not on the rise. The drug war was declared in, you know, response to racial politics. It was part of the Republican Party.
How do you show that, though? How do you prove something like that?
Well, actually, the historical facts are all there in the historical record. President Ronald Reagan and, you know, the Republican strategists at that time sought to appeal to poor and working class white voters who are resentful of and threatened by many of the gains of the civil rights movement, particularly desegregation, busing, and affirmative action. And Republican Party strategists and pollsters were very open about the fact that if you use racially coded political appeals on issues of crime and welfare, you could attract this group of so-called swing voters from the Democratic Party, part of the, you know, old Democratic New Deal coalition, and get them to defect from the Democratic Party and join the Republican Party. And the war on drugs was really an effort by, you know, Ronald Reagan to make good on campaign promises to get Duff to crack down on a group of people that had not so subtly been defined in the media and the political discourse as black and brown by launching the war on drugs. He got lucky because a couple years after the war on drugs was officially announced, crack cocaine hit the streets in inner cities across America, and the Reagan administration actually hired staff whose job it was to publicize crack dealers, crack babies, crack whores, crack-related violence in inner city communities in an effort to build public support for the war in the hopes of turning what had been a rhetorical war into a literal one. And the plan worked like a charm. You know, our television sets became saturated with images of black and brown drug users and dealers and violence associated with the crack trade in inner city communities. And Congress and state legislators, you know, nationwide responded by drastically increasing sentences, and a wave of punitiveness washed over the United States in response to these black and brown, you know, images of drug offenders.
We're going to have to take a short break. My guest is Michelle Alexander of the OSU Moritz College of Law and also of the OSU Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity. Her new book, it's called The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. If you have a question or comment, glad to take them. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News, Wednesday night at 9 on WOSU TV. POV presents Food Inc. with a look at the American agriculture business that produces more food on less land at cheaper costs than farmers of any other nation. Watch POV Wednesday night at 9 on WOSU TV. And remember, on your way home, get perspective on all the day's news on All Things Considered and the business news on Marketplace. Weekdays starting at 4 on WOSU 89.7 FM, NPR News, and classical music. 54 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:21. Some sunshine today, a high around 62. A few clouds tonight, a low of 40 degrees. Sunshine for Tuesday and a high of 65. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Michelle Alexander. She is a professor in the OSU Moritz College of Law. She is also with the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity. She has a new book out. It's called The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. And Michelle, I would imagine that your book doesn't go over well with a lot of people sometimes, or at least the thesis, depending on whether they've read it or not, is another story.
Yes, well, you know, the idea is controversial. People today very much want to cling to the idea that we've finally, as a nation, moved beyond race. And, you know, especially since the election of Barack Obama, people in the United States and around the world want to believe that we have finally triumphed over race. And I myself, as I indicate in the introduction of the book, I myself had a very difficult time accepting the idea that something akin to a racial caste system might be operating in the United States. In fact, when I was first, you know, presented with this idea more than a decade ago, I initially rejected it.
Who presented it? Well, how was it presented?
The first time I encountered this idea, I was actually living in Oakland, California, and rushing to catch a bus. And I noticed a bright orange sign posted to a telephone pole, and on it it read, "The drug war is the new Jim Crow." And I remember pausing and kind of scanning the text to the flyer, and I saw that a small, you know, group was holding a community meeting a few blocks away in a church, organizing against California's new three strikes law, the expansion of the prison system, and police brutality. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, the criminal justice system may be biased in a lot of ways, but it doesn't help to make such an absurd comparison. You know, people just think you're crazy. And then I crossed the street, hopped on the bus, on my way to my new job as director of the Racial Justice Project at the ACLU. Now, you know, when I began my work at the ACLU, I was very familiar with problems of racial bias and racial stereotyping infecting institutions. I had been a civil rights lawyer working on, you know, large class action employment discrimination cases against Fortune 500 companies. So I assumed the criminal justice system was much like all institutions in our society that are, you know, have problems to some degree or another with conscious and unconscious bias. But by the time I left the ACLU, I came to the conclusion that I had been wrong about the criminal justice system. After years of working on issues of racial profiling, drug law enforcement in communities of color, the extraordinary challenges faced by those who are attempting to, you know, quote unquote, re-enter into mainstream society, you know, I came to the conclusion I was wrong. And the criminal justice system is not just another institution in our society infected with racial bias. It's a different beast entirely. And the activists who posted the sign on the telephone pole weren't crazy, you know, nor were the smattering of lawyers and activists around the country that were beginning to connect the dots between mass incarceration and earlier forms of racial control. So it was really after years of working in the communities most impacted by mass incarceration that I started to see these young kids are being rounded up by the thousands for extremely minor, frequently nonviolent drug offenses, the same sorts of offenses that went on all the time in my own high school. I attended, you know, three different high schools growing up, and I got to see how different life is in different environments. And, you know, I remember going to relatively affluent, you know, white suburban high school where drug use was prevalent. Drug dealing was prevalent. There were no raids. Kids weren't stopped and searched, you know, on the way to school, on the way home. They weren't thrown down on the pavement and treated really like animals, all in this search for drugs. And once these kids are branded, the rest of their life, it is no longer a matter of working hard or staying in school. Once you've been branded a criminal, your life changes, and you become part of that undercast for life.
Now, we had a caller earlier. They hung up. They're angry at what you're saying, and they say that what you're doing with this thesis is inciting hatred, and it's and fomenting, you know, a race. I would imagine it's a racial hatred. What do you say to that?
Well, fomenting racial hatred is absolutely the last thing I'm interested in doing. You know, I think the reason we have this caste system today is because we have failed as a society to learn to show care, compassion, and concern to people of all races. You know, we've you know, embraced this idea of color blindness, which hasn't actually made us blind to different races. Instead, it's made us indifferent to people of different races, indifferent to their suffering, indifferent to their unique experience. And, you know, Martin Luther King Jr., you know, often warned his audiences that racial hostility and bigotry is not the root of racial caste systems. It's not the root of slavery. It's not the root of Jim Crow. It's indifference. It's the failure to care, genuinely care about people of different races that allows caste systems to emerge and to thrive over time. So really, this book is written, you know, most certainly not to inspire racial division or racial hatred, but rather to inspire racial healing. For us to take a look at, you know, this system that has emerged and ask ourselves, is this what we would want for anyone we actually cared about?
Or is this why things haven't gotten better? You know, that people say that. Why is it still a problem? Why is race still a problem in this country? Why can't we just get over it? It's been years and decades and hundreds of years. You know, why can't we get over it? And I guess that kind of, when you were talking like that, it makes me wonder, it's something that we can't see.
Yes, actually, you know, I think to a large extent, racial inequality was much more visible, both during slavery and Jim Crow. You know, there were signs that said whites only hanging over, you know, water fountains and bathrooms. And the caste system was very visible to all people of all colors. But today, people who are branded felons and shipped off to prison, they're out of sight and out of mind. And it's been possible for us, I think, to remain blind to the existence or the reemergence of a caste-like system in the United States, because we don't have to deal with it if we ourselves are not branded or a family member is not in the system itself. So it makes it a lot easier for us to ignore and turn a blind eye to when the folks who are suffering are literally out of sight.
If you're just joining us, this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. And my guest is Michelle Alexander, author of a new book. It's called The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. Michelle holds a joint appointment with the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity and the Moritz College of Law at Ohio State University, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Tom, you wanted to kind of continue that thread that we were just talking about. You're on the air.
Well, you know, after listening to Speakable, I came from a large Irish family, and we lived in a mixed neighborhood of everybody. And my school was predominantly of colored. And, you know, I've seen the prejudice card too, but one thing I was raised with by my father, and we were a poor family. I didn't know I was poor until I left, you know, moved on my own. That if you do a crime, be prepared to do the time and also pay the consequences. Mm-hmm. And we had drugs in our school, white and black and everything else. And it's choices that you have to make as to how your life will end up. And I feel a lot of the choices that people make nowadays are bad. And the reason why is they have no parental guidance.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the way the laws have gotten so much stricter, particularly the sentencing laws? Now, back when I was covering the legislature back in the early 90s, they had the three strikes and you're out stuff go through and all that kind of stuff. I mean, does that make people badder than they were before those three strikes?
I believe it does make some, but if you have a bad person, no matter what you do, you're not going to make them good.
But does a kid dealing a little bit of drugs, does that constitute a bad person to you?
It depends on what kind of drugs they are. Okay. If you're doing a hardcore drug, you know, when the first time they get busted for this, it depends also on the amount that they get busted with or arrested with. Okay. If it's a person under 17, they should be put into intensive rehab. Okay.
Michelle wouldn't necessarily disagree on the.
I wouldn't disagree with that. I mean, I think that the idea that people who use or experiment or even sell drugs are necessarily bad people is one that I think we need to, you know, carefully examine. I myself experimented with drugs in my youth. Barack Obama admitted to, you know, fairly extensive drug use in his youth. Now, if he had been branded a felon and treated like a common criminal, what are the chances he would be president of the United States today or even gotten, you know, his higher degrees and experienced success? No, if he had been branded a felon and not been protected, insulated by, you know, a university environment and, you know, growing up in Hawaii, his life course would have been radically different than the one he was able to travel. So, you know, my concern here with the drug war is that the exact same behavior, which is, you know, relatively minor drug use and sales, which goes on equally in communities of color and white communities, is treated radically differently when it's done by poor kids of color than it is when it's done by university students or middle class students. And those poor kids are asked to forfeit their lives. Forfeit their lives for experimenting with drugs, using drugs, you know, something that really is a public health problem has been converted into a criminal offense. And hardly any other Western democracy in the world treats drug use or sales the way the United States has done. And the reason we treat it the way we do has everything to do with our racial history and politics.
There's one of our emailers, but I can't see. They want you to talk about Haldeman's strategy and statement to President Nixon about using coded words to make this issue be about race without actually saying it. The writer, the emailer says, Tom, says that you talked about this on your recent interview with Bill Moyers.
Yes. You know, as I indicated earlier, you know, the drug war was part of this grand and highly successful Republican Party strategy of using racially coded political appeals on issues of crime and welfare to attract poor and working class white voters who were quite understandably threatened by and upset by, you know, desegregation, busing, and affirmative action. I mean, it was really their world that got rocked by the civil rights movement, not affluent whites who were able to send their kids to private schools and avoid much of the social upheaval. So there was reason for the anxiety that poor and working class whites felt. And Republican Party strategists recognized they could capitalize on this anxiety. And in the words of H.R. Haldeman, President Richard Nixon's White House chief of staff, he said, quote, "The whole problem is really the blacks. The key is to devise a system that recognizes this while not appearing to."
He actually wrote that.
He actually said that.
Okay.
And, you know, the racially charged, racially coded kind of political appeals on getting tough on crime and cracking down on welfare recipients, that was part of this strategy of attempting to appeal to this group of vulnerable, you know, voters who were experiencing a fair amount of anxiety post civil rights movement and trying to win them over. And it worked. And I should add, you know, all the fault for the system most certainly does not rest on the Republican, on the Ronald Reagan administration, the Clinton administration, in its effort to prove that the so-called new Democrats could be even tougher on crime. And in their effort to compete for the same block of kind of swing voters, escalated the drug war far beyond what the Reagan administration had even dreamed possible. The greatest, most dramatic expansion of our prison system occurred during the Clinton administration, not during the Reagan administration. And many of the laws that, you know, form the basic architecture.
The crack cocaine laws.
Yes, the crack cocaine laws, but also the laws banning drug felons from even food stamps for life. That was the work of the Clinton administration. And the laws banning people branded felons from public housing, again, that was the work of the Clinton administration. So the basic architecture of this new caste system is at least as much the product of Democratic administrations as it is Republican.
We have lots of calls, and I definitely want to get to them. Let's see. I'm working on this. Rod, you're on the air. You say you've been menaced by black men. What does this have to do with the conversation?
On three separate occasions, and maybe.
Well, what does it have to do with this?
Well, it's a question of basically, and maybe it has something to do with machismo or whatever. Working into it, I would apply this to the Latino community too. You see so often, about. Arguments or whatever, escalating into knife play or gun play, getting the police involved. And I'm wondering, I think that's one thing, getting into white flight to the suburbs from the school system. People don't want to raise their kids in a war zone. And I'm just, right. Wondering, how, I would agree there's some Jim Crow to it, but at the same time, it seems like certain groups, maybe it has something to do with lack, poverty or something, but seem to be unable to control themselves, when it comes to escalating fights or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Well, Michelle? I think there is this widespread perception that violent crime is on the rise. And that, violent crime rates are, worse than they've ever been. Actually, no. Crime rates are lower than they have ever been today. And, the racial stereotyping associated with violence and violent crime, I think, is one of the major reasons we see this impulse to be so incredibly punitive to people who are perceived to be black and brown, who are accused of crimes. When I attended, suburban white high school and kids, white kids got into fights on the playground, people didn't say, gosh, those white kids always getting into trouble. No, they were just kids getting into trouble. But you see, when, black or brown youth find themselves getting into serious fights or trouble, it's perceived as somehow reflecting on their race or on their culture. Now, it is true that violent crime rates in black and brown communities are higher than violent crime rates in white communities. Now, the reason for this differential, though, cannot be explained by black culture or something inherent in people of different races. In fact, in this wonderful book written by sociologist William Julius Wilson called When Work Disappears, he explains that if you control for joblessness, differences in violent crime rates between racial groups virtually disappears. In the United States, where there are high rates of joblessness, you can also find, relatively high rates of violent crime. And, in poor communities of color, there have been problems of severe joblessness now for a very long time due to deindustrialization and globalization and other factors, which explain violent crime rates to a much greater deal than race.
We're going to have to take another short break. My guest is Michelle Alexander, author of the book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. I want to get to all of your calls and your emails as well. We'll be right back to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Richard Clark, the former anti-terrorism czar who warned about the terrorist threat before 9/11, is now warning about cyber war. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Clark about what a full-scale cyber attack could look like, why we're vulnerable, and what we can do about it. It's the subject of his new book. Join us.
Fresh Air begins in just about 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Get the latest information from WOSU the way you want it, daily, biweekly, or monthly. Just go to wosu.org/email and sign up for one of our e-newsletters. And you can be a part of the studio audience with WOSU's Ann Fisher on Thursday, this Thursday, April 22nd at 6 p.m. Join Ann and guests at WOSU Ecosi to share your thoughts and feelings about pressing issues that face one of our city's most vibrant neighborhoods, Columbus's Short North. You can attend and be a part of the radio and TV audience for later broadcast of this WOSU event. To register, call 292-9678 or visit wosu.org. We hope to see you at COSI this Thursday at 6 o'clock. 53 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today, a high right around 62. A few clouds tonight and a low of 40 degrees. Sunshine for Tuesday and a high of 65 and more sunshine on Wednesday, a high near 70. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Michelle Alexander. She is the author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. It's got lots of you folks thinking out there because I see your phone calls. Let's take this one from Joe. You were a child care worker for 50 years, you said, and you get what Michelle's talking about?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Thank you, guys. Most of my work has been with the black community, both as a police officer and a social worker, and you name it. I started working in the early 60s, and absolutely, this is, you know, I think people are blind to their bigotry. I know I'm blind to mine most of the time. I worked in one of the cities, it's 96% black precincts, and my partner was black, and it was a very good time for all of us, even though at the time, you know, we saw, you know, the devastation in the community because there weren't, you know, the black boyfriends weren't allowed. They were there, and then they were not there, and it was absolutely, in this area we were in, there was no male guidance for the kids growing up.
Because they were all in jail.
Well, they were either in jail or on the run from jail.
Mm-hmm.
And then the school busing plan went into effect, and excuse me if I'm offending anybody, but just further divorced the mothers from their control over their children because their children were bust into white areas where there was no parental control, and there was no way that the mothers had contact with their children until they heard from the police. And it was just a terrible time. It was a wrenching away from, you know, this control. And I've heard some other callers call in and, you know, say, well, you know, I was raised this way and I was raised that way. And they failed to realize that, you know, these kids don't have that type of perennial, a lot of the kids, and these kids end up in prison. Now, I spent 35 years dealing with the population, trying, you know, with a, you know, pretty good staff, trying to teach them the responsibilities and how to acquire the responsibilities of being an adult, even though they haven't had, you know, the cushy benefits of having the two-family productive father and somebody to guide them. And I just want to say I agree with you 100%. And I've seen it on the down level. And, you know, my current population in my place is, that's not the name of my organization. Hey. I don't give it.
See, hey, Joe, could I ask you a question? Did you said you had 50 years in one way or another. Did you notice a difference when the war on drugs kicked in? Because you were... You were around then, did
yeah,
you?
I was actually on the streets when the so-called crack epidemic stepped in, and then it was like all the rules were gone, and kids were black kids in the black community. They were really getting severe. Small amounts of crack cocaine, even powder, were they were really jumped on, and then I'm sure the prison rate shot up because we were arresting people, virtually, on traffic stops. We would find a lot of stuff, and everybody went to jail, and everybody's property got.
Okay.
Yeah, hey, if I can respond
sure.
quickly to that, because he mentioned right there at the tail end that everybody's property got, confiscated, and one of the reasons, people ask me all the time. Well, why don't they concentrate on the drug kingpins, or the big-time dealers? Why is the drug war concentrated on these low-level offenders? And, a big part of the answer is that the drug war is designed in a way to ensure mass drug arrests. Federal funding flows to state and local law enforcement agencies that boost dramatically the sheer volume of drug arrests. Agencies get rewarded for their numbers, not for necessarily bringing down the drug bosses, but for the sheer numbers. So, stops and searches of cars, of people on streets occur in mass to boost these numbers without any regard to whether the people they're arresting are, big-time dealers or just small-time dealers. But also drug forfeiture laws. Federal drug forfeiture laws allow state and local law enforcement officials to keep up to 80% of the cash, cars, homes that they seize from suspected drug offenders.
Isn't that supposed to be stuff that was purchased with drug money, though?
That's the idea. However, if your cash or your car is confiscated, but you yourself aren't charged with an offense, you have no right to counsel in a forfeiture proceeding. None. Your cash is taken off, your person by an officer, or your car is seized.
As opposed to you get counsel if you're destitute and
right. Well, so
for the criminal proceeding.
Right. If you're charged with a crime, you get a right to counsel. But if your property is just taken, which is what happens very often in these drug raids, is lots of cash, or people's property is seized in the course of conducting these drug raids. And they believe, or they say they have reason to believe, that the cash is related to a drug transaction, but you're not actually charged. You don't have any right to counsel. And many people fear challenging these, forfeitures because they worry about retaliation and then being charged with a crime. Now, those kinds of practices would never fly in, middle class, upper middle class communities. But, law enforcement is able to get away with seizing cash, cars from, people in poor communities, knowing that they don't have access to counsel or unlikely to be able to represent themselves. And there'll be few, if any, political repercussions.
614-292-8513. I will tell you, callers, though, that the lines are jammed, which is great because you want to talk about this. That's important. Dale, you're on the air. You wanted to talk about the kids who were busted in Worthington. I assume you're talking about the heroin bust about 6 months ago. Hello, Dale? Dale? Dale must have hung up. Okay, sorry, Dale. Let's see then. Jim, you're on the air. Are you wondering if this is a conscious effort to remove black people from society?
Well, I would not have been ready to even hear this argument, 2 years ago. I always thought, racism is not a big deal, as you would think. It's a crime issue. It's a parent issue. It's a drug issue. It's every issue but that. But the author has presented this and articulated it in a way that actually makes a lot of sense. So, taking her thesis to be correct, some of these questions have been answered in that, where's the incentive to, say, disproportionately enforce these laws in black communities over, white, historically, suburban community or whatever? It seems like the system is set up in such a way that you can just do it, or is somebody consciously saying, hey, this is the plan, here's our plan, you help us by working this neighborhood, you know, and I can, that's my question, is there a question in there?
Yeah, well, yes. I guess you're saying racial, you know, biases notwithstanding, if someone doesn't realize they're doing it, then why are they doing it? What's the incentive?
Well, yeah, what's the incentive in this, you know, because I know, I've talked with my friends for a long time about this whole idea of disproportionate prison time that black people do, and I was always real comfortable to fall back in my little idea that that's where most of the crime is, even though the numbers are just crazy off the hook. But as I think about it, yeah, you know, the white people I know, I mean, they're doing as much petty drug crime as anybody else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's see what Michelle. Let's have Michelle respond. And Jim, thanks for your call.
Thank you so much for your topic today. It's really good.
Thank you. Jim.
Well, you know, I do not want to create the impression that everyone who's involved in drug law enforcement or all prosecutors are, you know, bigots. quite to the contrary, I think most people who are engaged in law enforcement, who work as police or prosecutors, have good intentions. But there are a couple of problems that are built into the system. The first is that it was born. This system was born as a result of racial politics, as I indicated. And it was born, you know, at a time when, you know, people's racial anxieties and fears were being exploited. And the crack crisis, the crack epidemic, allowed for media saturation of black and brown images, creating this perception in the public and within law enforcement that if you're looking for drug crime, if you're, you know, interested in going after drug dealers, the place to look are in poor communities of color. You know, even like I said, even though these studies have shown consistently that people of color are no more likely to use or sell illegal drugs, the imagery associated, you know, in the media and in our pop culture and the assumptions within law enforcement is that drug use is more prevalent and more severe in communities of color. So if you want to, you know, root out drug, you know, use and abuse, well, you need to go to poor communities of color. Also, all the financial incentives, as I indicated earlier, are to conduct these drug, you know, roundups in mass. And you cannot get away with what they do in poor communities of color today and middle class and suburban white communities. There's absolutely no way that, you know, middle class parents would tolerate having their kids stopped and searched on the way to school, you know, having their school swept on the suspicion of, you know, one kid possessing some marijuana, which is what happens in many urban schools. The way that these poor kids of color are treated would just never fly in suburban white communities. And because now there's these financial incentives built in where law enforcement stands to, you know, reap financially by conducting this drug war aggressively, and the only place they can really get away with doing it are in poor communities of color, the drug war rages on. Really out of sight and out of mind of most people who don't live in those communities.
Okay, the Dale who called earlier to talk about the Worthington kids, he's back on the line. I don't know what happened, Dale, but you're back with us. Welcome to the show.
Yeah. Sorry.
I guess you're talking about the kids who were busted for heroin possession, right?
Well, yeah. I think that just as a note, is something that is worth observing in terms of how that unfolds in terms of penalties. I mean, I'm sure the parents already have, you know.
Yeah, nothing's happened yet on that, right?
No, I don't think so. Yeah. But I imagine most of the parents have, you know, collected enough money to send them to some colleges and schools because it's an affluent neighborhood.
Well, I think that it made news just because it was a bunch of white kids from Worthington.
Absolutely.
Otherwise,
absolutely.
You know, are you from Worthington, Dale?
No.
Okay.
But the in terms of the policies that have been introduced over the number of decades from people who wanted things to be, is a comparison. Here's a comparison. Back when the stock market opened and, you know, was possible and, you know, before the crash and stuff, Al Capone told everyone it was a racket and that everyone should get in and make their money before it was considered illegal. And it still exists today. When there are entities and powers that want something, generally, they use money. Money is, oh my gosh, Money is why the stock market exists. Money is why we had the crash. Money is why local police agencies, you know, are doing what they're doing. I agree. There's a lot of really good police officers out there. A lot. I mean, they're all mostly. But there's this incentive of money, and when you throw money in the mix, you can pretty much accomplish whatever you want. Whatever you want. In this case, what it is. Mm-hmm. I don't want to give a name to it.
Well, Dale, I want to move on to another caller, but I appreciate your call.
Okay, no problem.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
I just want to bring up, there's an email from Kelly, writes, your guest appears on the verge of drowning in her own crocodile tears. An individual's financial state has nothing to do with knowing right from wrong. Perhaps our justice system is attempting to send the message that drug activity is a serious offense and society as a whole wants no part of it. While drug activity may be occurring in suburbs, do you really expect to see gangbangers hanging out in Dublin? I think I want to go to Kelly's point about an individual's financial state has nothing to do with knowing right from wrong. Is that what you're saying?
No.
Or does it have to do with their ability to defend themselves in the courts and...
Yeah, no. I mean, again, the point that I'm making here is that we all as human beings make mistakes, young people in particular, but all human beings make mistakes. People of all colors experiment with drugs, sell drugs, use them. You know, there's no one among us really as an adult who hasn't committed a crime. We all have. You may have drunk underage, you may have experimented with drugs, you sped on the freeway. Speeding on the freeway is more likely to result in serious injury than, you know, smoking marijuana in the privacy of your own home. We've all, you know, committed crimes of one degree or another, but only some of us are targeted, and only some of us are branded felons for life and relegated to a permanent second-class status. So the question is, who's being targeted and why? And should we be branding people as felons for what amounts to a public health problem? Those are the questions I'm attempting to raise here, which is, you know, who's being targeted? Why? And does it make sense for us to respond in a wholly punitive fashion to a public health problem? And I think the root of this is that, again, we have not yet as a society cultivated a sense of care, compassion, and concern for people living in ghetto communities. We tend to have a punitive response to their suffering, to their mistakes, while, you know, kids in suburban communities making the identical mistakes
are just being kids
and are given support, drug treatment, counseling, an attempt to, support them in their, you know, rough transition from adolescence to adulthood. And why don't we extend that same sense of care, compassion, and concern? Well, I think it has a lot to do with race and the healing that has not yet been completed in our nation around, you know, our racial history.
Just one more email, and then we're going to have to close the show. I'm sorry, Michelle, because we have so many calls and so many emails. This is from Catherine, other side of the coin from Kelly. I agree totally with the author's premise, and thankfully she is so articulate. As a white parent, I feel that our war on drugs has not helped our kids, but it has increased our racism, unbeknownst to many white people. I'm glad this book is out there.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And I will be speaking on Friday at the Hale Black Cultural Center about the book at 11:30.
Okay, we'll put a link on WOSU.org/allsides. With that, thank you, Michelle Alexander, for being with us today.
Thank you.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820, NPR News.